Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage and KNOM Radio in Nome. The Iditarod, of course, is a sled dog race connecting those two cities with a 1,000-mile-long trail. But before we head out on the Iditarod Trail, there's a big ceremonial start to the race coming up. And before that, we have a quick word from the folks that help us pay for this coverage.
Hi, I'm Holly from the marketing team here at Alaska Public Media. Keep our Iditarod coverage thriving. Your support today helps fund journalism at Alaska Public Media. Visit alaskapublic.org/Iditarod to give today. Plus, you can receive an Iditapod sticker as a thank you gift with a donation of $5 a month or $60 annually. Thanks for listening.
That's right. You can get a sticker. I actually saw one out in the wild one time, though I should admit the person had about 100 stickers on their car, and I think they were all sort of holding the car together. So similarly, figuratively, we're holding it together here with stickers, and we're holding it down here with our little team that'll be out on the trail. Two familiar faces, or should I say voices, veteran Iditarod reporters Lex Trinan and Ben Matheson. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, Casey.
Hey, Casey.
Real quick, who are you again? What's your deal?
This is Lex. This is my second year reporting on the Iditarod, and I've been reporting on dog racing for about 5 years, and I am from Anchorage, Alaska.
And my name is Ben. I've been around the Iditarod since 2011 when I was working at KNOM in Nome, and so I've been able to follow dog mushing in Bethel at KYUK on the Kuskokwim, and I'm super excited to be back on the trail for this year's Iditarod.
Awesome. Yeah, we are excited to have both of you back. We're also going to hear from Alaska Public Media's digital managing editor, Tegan Hanlon, also a veteran trail reporter who's coordinating all of our coverage here. She's going to tell us about what Iditarod-y stuff you can expect at alaskapublic.org and elsewhere online. In this one and only pre-race episode this year, we're going to recap last year's Iditarod, the 50th running of the race, though now I guess we're into the 50th year of the Iditarod, which was confusing to us as journalists, notoriously bad at math, but we consulted with a mathematician and it all checks out. So yeah, a full half century of the last great race. However, this year we have the smallest Iditarod field ever, and we're going to talk more about that and how the Iditarod is maybe struggling a little bit. The race is also missing one of its most iconic and successful mushers, Lance Mackey, who passed away in September. We'll hear from his brother, Jason, who's running this year's race and says he's going to be carrying Lance's ashes, actually. There's also a father and son pair of rookies, as well as a bunch of other rookies that we're going to talk about. And we even have a dog profile. We'll explain all that as well as how our listener questions work. We'll also talk about what to expect over the next roughly 2 weeks of racing. As much as we can even anticipate what to expect, there's a lot of chaos out there. Sometimes you think you know what the theme or the story of the race is going to be, and it changes. So as much as we can predict what's going to happen. First, though, let's recap last year's race to Nome. We had a pretty normal ceremonial start in Anchorage last year, other than all the snow that was falling. This year, it looks like the forecast is for clear and cold, so, you know, you get one or the other. I say last year was normal because that was after the 2021 race that had these really strict COVID precautions, no ceremonial start. The race route was changed and did not go to Nome for the first time in its history. And just to quickly explain for those new to the race, the city of Anchorage shuts down 4th Avenue and Cordova Street. That's right downtown. And in somewhat of a twist, the city crews that are in charge of clearing snow now are dumping snow onto the streets. They actually stash away good, clean snow just for this. And the Iditarod teams do an untimed run from downtown where thousands of people, literally thousands, are gathered. And then also along city trails where there are more like hundreds of people enjoying themselves. They mush along for about 10 or 11 miles. It's really just kind of a fun event, definitely more of a parade, or I've heard it described as a pageant, than it is a race at that point. And it gives city folk a chance to see the dogs, the mushers, the sleds doing their thing, which they'll be doing way out there in the wilderness for the most part. So Lex, you were out on the trail last year. Can you give us a quick recap of the 2022 Iditarod? There were run-ins with moose on the trail that were trying to stay out of the deep snow. We kind of thought that was going to be a theme. It turned out that it was. But can you kind of run through how the race went last year?
Right. And just like the ceremonial start, the first part of the race seemed to go pretty smooth. We didn't hear of any major mishaps. It wasn't until after Galena on the Yukon River that there was a run-in with moose. And just for listeners who might be unfamiliar with that, when there's deep snow, the moose have trouble staying up on top of it with their long, skinny, pointy hooves. So they like to stay on more established trails. And a lot of times moose will feel threatened by dogs mistaking them for wolves. And there was a musher, Matt Failer, who had to shoot a moose. Some mushers do carry firearms with them, and he shot a moose outside of Galena. As per race rules, he had to salvage that moose, the carcass and all, and report it to the race marshal, but he did continue on and eventually finish the race. As far as the front of the pack, there was a group of about five mushers that sort of separated themselves by midway. That was led by Brent Sass. There was also Ryan Reddington, Mitch Seavey and his son Dallas Seavey, and then Hugh Neff. When they arrived in Ruby, the first checkpoint on the Yukon River, Neff unexpectedly sort of withdrew from the race, and at the time, race officials didn't say much, but we gathered that veterinarians were concerned about the health of Hugh Neff's dogs. Basically, they were too skinny, and race officials forced him to scratch.
Told that I had a choice of scratching or being disqualified, so for the sake of the mushing community, I decided to scratch.
Yeah. So he was kind of forced to scratch from the race. And I guess, you know, Hugh's had some questions about his dog care. He was banned from the Yukon Quest after a dog and his team died in that race a few years ago. He kind of had to fight his way back, requalify for the Iditarod. And then in that race last year that he had to requalify for, he was pretty much forced to withdraw. We're going to talk more about him because this kind of interesting thing, a couple interesting things actually happened with him after last year's Iditarod. So we're going to return to Hugh Neff. But back to how the race shaped up last year. Down the stretch, the storyline really turned to Brent Sass, the veteran Iditarod musher from Interior Alaska. He's got multiple championships in the Yukon Quest. He's vying for his first Iditarod championship last year, though. And he was really, you know, later in the race competing against five-time champ Dallas Seavey. I mean, Brent probably had it in his head that he was going to be competing with Dallas the whole time, but that is how it shaped up. Dallas, of course, was trying to win his sixth Iditarod, which would have made him the winningest Iditarod musher of all time. Lex, do you remember where along the trail it started to become clear that first place was going to come down to either Brent Sass or Dallas Seavey?
Right. By Unalakleet, the two had a little bit of a cushion, but there's a lot of challenging stretches of trail in front of that. One of the sections that really stood out to me was going across Norton Sound. That's the run from Shaktulik to Koyuk. It's wide open, no cover really at all for that stretch. They're just on open ice. And I remember flying over with our pilot. I remember the pilot sort of grumbling to me because we were going into such a strong headwind. And he was saying, you know, this is impossible for dog team to run in. There's no way they're out on the ice. Pretty soon we do see a little dot, and it was Dallas Seavey. His dogs were pulling him despite that strong headwind, and he was hunkered down behind his sled, keeping his head down out of the wind. And that was pretty impressive in itself. But as we kept flying along, we reached the next team, and that was Brent Sass. He wasn't hunkered down at all. He was, in fact, head in the wind, kicking and ski pulling alongside his team. And that was when I really thought, man, this guy might really do it this time. It's one of the places where a lot of the race has already been decided. And of course, once they get into White Mountain, that with the mandatory 8-hour rest, that's really where there's very little that can happen that can derail a musher's plan. But of course, it has happened before.
Totally. It's definitely happened before. I mean, I've seen it happen, you know, where you think that whoever's in first place has such a big lead by the time they get to White Mountain. Like you said, they have that 8 hours that every musher has to take a mandatory break there to rest the teams before they make that final push to Nome. And again, last year, something did happen. You have already alluded to that. It was kind of the culmination of the race is always really exciting right there at the end. But then the way things played out, it was just this, like, I mean, for me, and I think a lot of people watch it, just like this deeply anxiety-inducing event. Please describe that for me.
Right. So just to recall, Brent Sass comes into White Mountain with, I think, a little over 2 hours of a lead, which is doesn't sound like a whole lot after 8 days of racing, but it is pretty comfortable for these top level racers. When they left after their 8 hours, things at first seemed to be going pretty smoothly for Brent Sass based on the race tracker. Things started to get tough with the weather. Watching from my bed in Nome, we could see that Sass's team had stalled somewhere between the checkpoint of White Mountain and Nome, and we were just watching, waiting, seeing if his tracker was going to start moving. Meanwhile, Dallas's tracker icon was creeping closer and closer. After quite a bit of time, though, Sass's beacon did start moving again, and very slowly at first, but then he started gaining speed. It turned out that he'd had a sled runner break and then tumbled down an icy, wind-blown side hill. His dogs were basically covered with snowdrifts immediately because of those intense winds. He showed us a video later and it was just howling. He was also lost.
I look up and there's the trail is gone. There's not. I don't really have any bearing of which way is where the trail is at all. So at that point, I turned a headlight on my handlebar so that I could see the sled. Because if he walked away 10 feet, the sled was gone.
Eventually, he does find the trail, and his dogs got up and pulled him all the way to the finish for his first Iditarod win.
Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, you're like everybody else, you're watching the GPS tracker to just try to figure out when he's going to arrive. I mean, logistically, as a reporter, you want to know when to head down to the finish line. Those of us watching from afar on the GPS tracker saw the same thing, that he had just stopped. And I think from past experience, and I'm thinking about the 2014 race where Jeff King was in the lead, had a bigger cushion than that, even out of White Mountain, and then ended up scratching, you know, on that last stretch, basically, you know, I think less than 20 miles from Nome because of a huge storm. We all wondered, did something happen to Brent that caused him to have to scratch? Is that how close he's going to get to winning this race? And of course, like you said, he got him back up that hill, got him back on the trail, you know, with Dallas hot on his heels for sure. You know, must have been motivated greatly, I think, by Dallas being pretty close behind him to get there.
Absolutely. And in the post-race interview, I remember him making a comment about his own internal monologue during that time. And he was telling himself, is this going to be Brent Sass pulling another Brent Sass? Because he has had some high-profile meltdowns towards the end of the race where his team wasn't able to follow through on a promising start.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, go back to the Yukon Quest. He fell off his sled close to the end of that race when he was in the lead one time and got concussed and had to drop out. There's, you know, numerous stories of him, you know, giving up placement in different races to help mushers that were struggling or, you know, in a dangerous situation, really. You know, it's just interesting that he, like, has gone through all of that. And I think for a lot of these guys, those experiences have hardened them to the point that they become Iditarod champions eventually. And that's what you saw with Brent. And I just want to mention, too, there is a much longer version of that story that you can find if you just scroll back in your podcast feeds or if you're listening at alaskapublic.org/Iditarod. And just sticking with Brent Sass here for just a second and his storytelling abilities, I guess I'll say. I saw him one time on stage for a storytelling event in Fairbanks. And, you know, he does these Arctic tours where he takes folks out dog mushing. And I thought it was interesting at this event. He didn't tell a story about being in the Yukon Quest or the Iditarod. He told a story about guiding in the Arctic where he just had this, you know, ridiculous experience with overflow. Is extremely cold. Overflow, you know, is out on the rivers. It's water that gets pushed up on top of the ice. And he's kind of laughing his way through it. And then you sort of realize, like, oh, you could have died, though. Okay. You know, speaking of the Arctic, if I can make a awkward segue, there's this really popular mid-distance race in the Arctic that actually happens after the Iditarod. It's called the Kobuk 440. It runs from Kotzebue to Kobuk and back. And Lex, you actually covered the Kobuk 440, and this is my way of getting back to Hugh Neff, because after he was basically forced to scratch in the Iditarod, just like less than a month later, he goes to the Kobuk 440 and he wins that race, right?
Right, by just 2 minutes. And just to be clear, I was not up there, but I did get a phone interview with Neff after his win. He said it felt like a vindication.
Vindication. I don't want to be in any type of battle with people, but unfortunately, I'm in a battle that wasn't of my choosing, and it's something I'm not going to back down from.
Well, in this case, vindication only lasted so long, and that's because the Iditarod's qualifying review board rejected Hugh Neff's entry into this year's race based on his history, and despite that win in the Kobuk 440. I tried to reach Hugh about that when we learned about it in December. He never responded to my messages, so I kind of only got the Iditarod side of it. But they basically said that, yeah, the Iditarod's qualifying review board, you know, they review every musher's application. It's not just guaranteed if you're a veteran that you're going to enter. And, you know, they look at a bunch of different things. And for the rookies, that includes, you know, whether they have completed their qualifiers. In Hugh's case, though, he's, you know, run the Iditarod a bunch of times. And it just came down to, I think, if I'm reading their press release correctly, that I think they just kind of wanted to avoid a similar situation this year. And that, to me, that all seems to signal that the Iditarod is trying very hard to, you know, first of all, keep a very high standard for dog care. And I think secondly, they want to show the world and maybe some people who are skeptical about dog mushing that they're doing everything they can to do right by those dogs. Coincidentally, this rejection of Neff's entry happened right around the time the Iditarod announced it would not require mushers entering the 2023 Iditarod to be vaccinated against COVID, which is and has been still a huge concern, especially for those remote village checkpoints. And the race officials said that decision not long before the entry deadline did not have anything to do with the low number of teams signed up. But right after the announcement, we saw some veteran top 10 finishers who had sat out because of the vaccine requirement, they quickly signed up. Even so, the field of mushers in this year's Iditarod is the smallest ever. And that's after years of some big-name sponsors pulling out and other challenges, including the impact that COVID has had on dog mushing tourism and just kind of like everything in our lives, financial concerns that people have. I've heard a bunch of different reasons. You know, some folks that got to the point that they wanted to start families just didn't have time to do like the competitive dog mushing. Some folks seem like they've, you know, sort of retired because they got to the other end of that spectrum. Lex, you did a story about all of that for us. How do you want to set this up?
Yeah, as you said, it's a lot of complicated reasons why mushers and teams aren't signed up this year, including the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think it's worth highlighting before the start of the story that there's not really any large reams of data we can draw on to make any conclusions. So it's a lot of just anecdotal stories and evidence about what is happening. But I did my best to talk to as many mushers and officials as I could. And I also wanted to hear about some of the solutions to this low field size and what organizers are thinking about going into the next 10 years or so.
Interesting. All right, here's that story.
Outside at his kennel in Knik, Iditarod musher Jason Mackey is assessing his dwindling supply of dog food. His freezer has just a few slabs of frozen salmon. There's a few boxes of frozen ground beef in the snow next to a few frozen whole king salmon. His kibble is almost gone, and he's not looking forward to a trip to the feed store. Not in this economy.
2004, I ran my first Iditarod. We paid $28 a bag for the red paw kibble that we feed today, and today that bag of dog food's $68.
Mackey is racing the Iditarod this year, but he says it's harder than ever to keep up with costs. Prices on kibble and beef have disproportionately shot up in the last few years, and salmon from the Yukon River have been harder to come by with recent fisheries closures. Mackey says he's been in the sport long enough to learn how to adapt.
We go without so the dogs can go with, and that's just the lifestyle.
But is that sort of self-sacrifice going to keep attracting mushers to Alaska's iconic 1,000-mile sled dog race? The mushing community is divided over just how serious this year's low sign-up is for the future of the Iditarod. 15 years ago, nearly 100 mushers lined up for the start, compared to the record low 33 this year. Iditarod CEO Rob Urbach says he's not panicked yet.
This year's a little bit of a strange year. We've had a number of people taking time off. We've had a number of people that have timed out. you know, we don't really think it's necessarily a trend.
Five-time champion Dallas Seavey is sitting out this year's race to spend time with family, as are Mushers Aaron Burmeister and former champion Joar Olsson. There's also an older generation of mushers stepping away this year, like Jeff King, Martin Boozer, and Ali Zirkel. While CEO Urbach is hopeful for the race's future, he still says this year's low turnout is a wake-up call, and the Iditarod organization has some ideas for developing the next generation of mushers. He says the Iditarod plans to start a shorter race for younger mushers that starts at the same time as the 1,000-miler, and to help with costs, it's looking into organizing food-buying co-ops to help mushers save a few bucks on their kibble. Three-time race champion Mitch Seavey is sitting out this year's race to let his body recover, but he thinks the organization should be doing more.
You know, it's no secret. The Iditarod has a $4 million budget. It makes me wonder why the purse isn't bigger and why the mushers aren't being supported.
Seavey thinks the Iditarod should host monthly races to keep enthusiasm for the sport high throughout the winter and do more to grow the fan base. He also says increasing the prize purse would help, something last year's third-place finisher Jesse Holmes agrees with.
It gives more opportunity for, you know, a professional musher to go out and race for purse money, which is huge.
Holmes says that top mushers like himself will plan out their race seasons based on prize money. The Iditarod's total prize purse, divided among finishers, has held steady at about $500,000 since 2018. It's about half of what it was 15 years ago, even without accounting for significant inflation. Urbach, the CEO, says the Iditarod hopes to boost the purse, but attracting new sponsors has been difficult. Several large corporate sponsors have pulled out in the last decade, some after they were pressured by animal rights groups who believe long-distance dog sled racing amounts to animal abuse. On top of that, the organization is dealing with its own cost increases.
Inflation disproportionately hit us. You know, our supply chain costs have gone up 30% over the last 18 months, so it's pretty significant for us as well.
One potential solution to help keep the Iditarod viable, he says, is state funding. He says he's in discussions with the state legislature to step in and help support the race financially and keep Alaska's state sport strong.
All right. Thanks for that, Lex. Good story. I've also heard that fewer people have been getting into dog mushing as kids. It's kind of that all the kids want to do these days is play video games argument. I'm not totally sure that that's true, though. And I'm thinking about Huslia here, where they have a partnership with the school to teach dog mushing. And, you know, elsewhere, I mean, we had a story just last night on our nightly news program, Alaska News Nightly. It mentioned that the junior Iditarod this year had its largest field since 2009. That, of course, is for dog mushers that are not old enough to enter the Iditarod by rule. And it kind of is like a pipeline for, you know, up-and-coming mushers who are younger that want to get into the big Iditarod. And like I said, I mean, they had the most mushers they've ever had in the junior Iditarod since 2009. By the way, shout out to Emily Robinson from Nenana for winning her second junior Iditarod in a row this year. I mean, she seems like somebody likely headed to the big show someday soon, you know, still somewhat younger than other mushers, but seems like on that path. Of course, you don't need to be young to be considered a rookie in the big kids Iditarod. A lot of folks find themselves well into adulthood by the time they even get into dog mushing, let alone reaching the starting line of the Iditarod. And in fact, some mushers who've already started the race and mushed the Iditarod Trail somewhat are still considered rookies. And on that, we're going to turn to Ben Matheson to explain, how does the Iditarod define the word rookie anyway?
It sounds like a really simple question. What is a rookie? But in Iditarod, there's two types of rookies. There's the true rookie who's running the Iditarod for their very first time. And then there's other rookies who just haven't finished the race. They maybe tried and started once, but had to scratch or couldn't finish, and then they're running as a second time, but they're still a rookie. Until you cross the finish line in Nome and you get that belt buckle, you are still an Iditarod rookie. I look back at the Iditarod race rules, and it is only true rookies, first-time rookies, who are eligible for the Rookie of the Year award. So two types of rookies, only one of which are eligible for the Rookie of the Year award.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that you actually have to be a first-time rookie to win Rookie of the Year. And you mentioned the belt buckle, the coveted Iditarod finisher's belt buckle. You can also get a personalized plate in Alaska if you're an Iditarod finisher. You see them around town. I'll see people driving around with those on their car, and I'll, you know, if I don't recognize them, I'm like, hey, you run the Iditarod? There's actually like a lot more people than you would think.
That's also a personal habit of mine. If I see somebody with an Iditarod finisher license plate, I always ask them, who are you? Do I know you? What year did you run Iditarod?
Yeah.
And there's a grand total of, I think this is the exact number, but 842 thereabouts from, that's from Iditarod CEO Rob Urbach. So we have an exact number on that. Fewer people than have climbed Mount Everest.
That's what I was just going to say. Yeah, that's something people throw out. Is like, it's actually, in some people's mind, harder to finish the Iditarod than it is to climb Mount Everest. I mean, arguably. This is not a guided expedition. And, you know, definitely being a rookie in this race is a disadvantage. You don't know the trail as well as anybody else that's been along it. It takes years to kind of build up that knowledge of, you know, where you want to run, where you want to rest, where the best place to stop is, all that. And Ben, I think it's what, like it's 1 in 4 mushers in this year's race as a rookie?
So this year, 9 out of the 33 mushers are rookies. So 6 of them are true rookies doing it for their very first time, but 3 of them are second year rookies. And they made it almost all the way to Nome before being caught in one of the infamous Topcock blowhole storms, one of these ground blizzards that come up and just create really dangerous, hazardous conditions with blinding snow conditions. So 3 of the rookies were caught in that storm and had to scratch because it was dangerous, and they needed outside help to get out of the race and be healthy. So Bridget Watkins, Gerhard Tiart, and Katie Jo Dieter are 3 of those mushers who made it almost all the way to Nome before getting caught in that storm, and they're back to do it again. They want that belt buckle, and they've got the teams to hopefully make it all the way to Nome this time.
Yeah, no doubt. So those are some of the folks that are returning as rookies again to try to finish the Iditarod. But you also spoke to some other rookies that really it is their first time. And one of them was Bailey Vitello. Tell me about Bailey.
So Bailey is the son of a father-son combination that's running the Iditarod this year. His father, Greg, is running his first Iditarod. So 2 rookies, father and son from New Hampshire. And they've been on this lifelong journey where Bailey's been on the sled runners since he was 3, growing up with dogs, loving dogs, and growing into a dog musher. He's, you know, raced all across the lower 48, the stage stop race. He's raced overseas in France, and he's done the junior Iditarod. But it's all kind of culminated in being ready for this Iditarod right here. So for Bailey Vitello, this is 2 decades in the making, but it's really his entire life in the making. And I got a chance to speak with him when he finished up his very last kind of major training run this weekend. And so I asked Bailey, you know, after all these years of training and all this work to get to the starting line, you know, what did he see in that dog team on that last final run?
I think realizing that after a 3,000 plus mile training season, the most miles I've ever done training, and realizing that this is the best my kennel's ever looked conditioning going into a race, and confidently knowing that the team's ready. There's no doubt in my mind the dogs are ready. Whether I'm ready or not, it doesn't matter. The dogs are ready. If they're ready to go, I'm ready to go. So I think that really clicks with me that the dogs are ready and I'm ready now. Knowing they're ready and confident that they're healthy and happy will be a big motivator to keep going.
So Ben, you actually have a larger story for us about those rookies in this year's race. Like you said, about a quarter of them are rookies. How do you want to set that up?
So they come from all walks of life. There's Eddie Burke Jr., a longtime garbage truck driver from Anchorage, who's turned into a star in mid-distance racing and running dogs from Aaron Burmeister's kennel. And then this father-son pair, each attempting their first run, Greg and Bailey Vitello. And then I talked to Hunter Keefe, who's completing his lifelong dream of preparing to run Iditarod. He started following the race when he was a kid in Michigan. And as soon as he graduated high school, he went and he followed that dream. He did the hustle working for dog teams across Alaska and is finally ready to race, and he's running Ramey Rennington's dogs. There's a Tennessee through hiker and Denali climber, Jennifer Labar, who's doing her first race.
Jennifer Labar got hooked on long distance adventures while hiking 1,000 miles on the Appalachian Trail.
But it got me in the mindset of like, man, this long distance stuff, these really big epic journeys is just life changing in a really good way.
She's already climbed Denali, and now it's on to the 1,000-mile Iditarod. 40-year-old Labar is eager to get into the same travel mindset with her 14 dogs.
I'm going to pack all my stuff, and we're going to hit the trail. And after so many miles, we're going to take a break and, you know, just rest and eat, and then take off and run again.
Labar is among the 9 rookies in this year's small field of 33 mushers. though three of them raced last year and nearly reached the finish in Nome before being caught in a ground blizzard and dropping out, so they're still considered rookies. But for Labar, who lives in Healy, this is her very first Iditarod. That's the case for 33-year-old Eddie Burke Jr., too. His introduction to dog mushing came when he showed up at the Iditarod banquet to get some gambling intel.
I knew nothing about dog mushing. I went to this banquet with some friends because we were betting on Iditarod, and we were basically there to do a recon mission and talk to mushers and, you know, see who was who had what and who was confident and that kind of thing.
Something clicked that night, and Burke started running dogs for fun with friends. But his race career accelerated 3 years ago when musher Aaron Burmeister asked him to take over racing his team. Burke quit his job driving a garbage truck at Anchorage and moved to Nenana to run dogs.
You know, I didn't think about it too long. I was hooked on mushing. I fell in love with it.
And then he wanted to take it to the next level. He's quickly built up a reputation in mid-distance racing by winning the Kinnick 200 and placing third in the challenging Kuskokwim 300 in Bethel. Like Burke, 23-year-old rookie Hunter Keefe is also running dogs from an established kennel. He's driving dogs for Ramey Reddington, the son of Iditarod founder Joe Reddington Sr.
Yeah, if you had told 6-7-year-old me that I'd be running my rookie race with Ramey Reddington's dog team, I don't think I would have even believed myself or anyone who told me that. It's pretty unreal and super special to be getting to race a team that's Ramey's life work.
Growing up in Michigan, he followed the race each March and imagined running it one day.
I never changed my dream. It always stayed the same. Like some kids want to be a firefighter for a year or two. For me, it was just dog musher and it never changed.
A love for dogs started early for 25-year-old Bailey Vitello, who was standing on the sled runners at age 3 with his dad, Greg. But 47-year-old Greg says it was Bailey who suggested they both run the Iditarod together as rookies, and he couldn't say no.
You know, son says, let's go do this now. Let's pick this year and let's just go do it. Because, you know, let's both do it in the same year.
The two New Hampshire mushers make up what may be the first ever pair of father-son Iditarod rookies in the same race. Bailey raced the junior Iditarod as a teenager and has been gearing up for the full race.
I've kind of just grown into the fact that, like, one day we'd want to run Iditarod. And it took a long time and generations of dogs and figuring out what direction we like and how to become a distance musher. And
Bailey has raced dogs in France, the lower 48, and Alaska, turning into what his dad describes as an impressive musher.
When he was little, I used to manage kennel and feed the dogs and pick the poop, right? You know, but now he's doing most of that stuff. And his work ethic is tireless. You know, it's impressive, you know, for a young guy. It's great to see. It's hard not to support that, right? And the idea that we can go do this together is amazing.
After leaving the race start in Willow, the Vitello's running schedules may not have much overlap. So, after a lifetime of preparing for Iditarod together, they'll plan to meet each other at the finish line in Nome.
Awesome. Good story, Ben. I always enjoy hearing about the rookies. It's kind of a different thing for them, especially the folks that are coming from the lower 48. And they've, you know, maybe done some mushing in Alaska, but this is the event. This is the Super Bowl of dog mushing. So, yeah, father and son out there on the trail at the same time, if not always in the same place. And I think now maybe we'll just keep it in the family, or, you know, with the family theme anyway. And let's talk about the Mackey brothers. In this case, it's Iditarod veteran Jason Mackey, who's running this year's race, and the late Lance Mackey, a four-time champion. Lex had a chance to talk with Jason Mackey, and here's what he said about Lance and about running this year's Iditarod.
I will have some of his ashes with me and spread them out. Some of our, you know, there's many places we've camped together. We've had good times, we've had bad times, we've had miserable times out there together. So we'll see where I spread him, but there's a couple of, you know, he loved Ophir, the checkpoint of Ophir, and so I'm definitely going to leave some of him there.
So Ben, Lance Mackey is not the winningest musher in Iditarod history, but he is iconic and he accomplished something that really nobody else has. Could you just kind of run us through his race history and I mean, why he became so famous as a dog musher in the Iditarod?
Lance Mackey strung together what may be the most impressive 6 years of dog mushing from 2005 to 2010. He won the Iditarod four times straight. He won the Yukon Quest four times straight. And he did what a lot of people thought was impossible. In 2007 and 2008, Lance Mackey won both the Quest and the Iditarod in the same year. It's something that people thought was impossible. It's something that people thought may have been dangerous. People didn't know how it was possible. But Lance Mackey had an absolutely stellar dog team for that stretch in history, and he proved to be the most dominant musher for that moment in history.
Yeah, doing back-to-back 1,000-mile races that are, what, like a couple weeks apart, basically, it seemed impossible, like you said. And then he proved that it was possible. And I remember at the time, people talking about it, and Lance talking about it, said, you know, these dogs, when you get them into race mode, they have this incredible metabolism. And what you really need to do is between the races, you have to keep running them so that they stay in race mode, basically, like in terms of how they're eating and they're just, you know, understanding that they're still on this run rest schedule. And a lot of folks would tell you that the musher is really the weakest link there. I mean, trying to rest up between those two races and be ready for the next one, you know, for the musher, that was like a bigger challenge than the dogs. I'm pretty sure that the only other musher to come close to winning both races in the same year was Sebastian Schnula from Whitehorse Yukon Territory, who won the Yukon Quest in 2009 and then the same year finished second in the Iditarod. But I don't recall anyone else really even coming close to that. And just turning back to Lance Mackey, part of the legend of Lance Mackey is that he is a cancer survivor. He had throat cancer. He lost his saliva glands, or they were somehow impacted due to his cancer treatment. So he had always kind of struggled racing in the Iditarod to like keep, you know, liquid in his throat to like keep himself like hydrated and lubricated. And then I think it was somewhat later, he was struggling a lot with his hands getting cold and he had Raynaud's syndrome. And I think that was also maybe related to his cancer treatment. So, you know, after that string of victories, he kind of dropped off. He wasn't, you know, one of the top 10 mushers there for a while. He had a pretty good race in 2020, but then a few months after the race, the Iditarod announced that he had actually tested positive for having methamphetamine in his system. So he was disqualified from that race. That was the last one that he ran. There was kind of a string of tragic events. His partner, mother of his kids, passed away in an ATV accident. His mom died. And then, of course, in September of last year, according to his Facebook page, Mackey's Comeback Kennel Facebook page, he was re-diagnosed with cancer and then, you know, passed away in September of 2022. Anyway, just to turn back to the incredible back-to-back wins in the Iditarod and Yukon Quest, which, again, Mackey accomplished twice. No one else has ever done it. It makes me wonder if that'll ever happen again. I mean, obviously a lot of things have to come together, a good dog team, an experienced musher, luck with a lot of stuff, including the weather, like not getting hit by a storm at the wrong time, even just the desire and the financial ability to support entering both races. And then with all of that, right now, the biggest obstacle seems to be that there is no longer a 1,000-mile Yukon Quest. We don't really know if that's ever going to be a thing again. Lex, you've at this point covered just about every different version of the Yukon Quest. Can you remind me what all the different lengths of the races that you've covered have been?
Right. When I started covering it in 2019, it was still the 1,000-mile Yukon Quest, and it alternates starting 1 year in Fairbanks and traveling to Whitehorse. And then the next year it will go from Whitehorse to Fairbanks. So that happened for 2 years. And then the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2021. It was the first year that the Yukon Quest was affected. The organizers put on 300 and 350 mile races those first 2 years of the pandemic. And then this last year, they were shooting for the 1,000-mile race, but last spring there was a disagreement between the Canadian and Alaska organizers.
Explain that to me a little bit more, and where are we at now with that?
Right. So the disagreement with the Canadian organizers seemed to stem from a rule requirement that the Canadian side was pushing for to require quite a bit more rest at checkpoints. The Alaskan side balked at the disagreement, and there's still some confusion over exactly what happened. But ultimately, the Alaska side announced that it was no longer cooperating on hosting a 1,000-mile race with the Canadian side, and instead they would run their own 550-mile race. The Canadian side of the Quest announced its own 450-mile race. I think the rules disagreement over the rest times was sort of a superficial reason, though. The Quest, just like the Iditarod, had been struggling with lower enrollment in the last few years. The last time they raced the full 1,000-mile race, I think something like 10 finishers finished. So they were already struggling, and I think that put a lot of pressure on the organizers, and ultimately the cooperation fell apart.
Yeah, and then, like you said, I mean, the COVID pandemic in there, and it kind of just never recovered from that. I guess also it's like there's always been these two different boards of directors. There's the one in Fairbanks, there's the one in Whitehorse. And, you know, whether it's about the amount of time that they want mushers to rest their dogs and they're disagreeing about that or just anything else, it seems difficult when you've got two different organizations basically having to come together to run a 1,000-mile race that, you know, by the way, does like cross an international border. So there's that. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have no sense of whether or not that 1,000-mile race will come back, right?
Right. At this point, I would be very surprised if it ever did. Not only is cooperation and mending that relationship going to be hard, but a lot of mushers themselves said they were quite happy with that 550-mile distance. As we mentioned before, two back-to-back 1,000-mile races for mushers who want to do both the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. That's quite a tall order, and a lot of mushers said they really liked doing this 550-mile distance as sort of a warm-up for the Iditarod.
Yeah, including our current Iditarod champ, Brent Sass. And we mentioned that we have an extended interview with Brent after he won last year's race. We're going to have another extended interview that you conducted with him around the Quest time where you were covering that. It'll be here on the Iditapod soon. We're going to have more of those longer extended interviews ahead on the Iditapod as we head out to talk to folks for the ceremonial start Saturday. And then, of course, as the race progresses from Sunday on. But wait, there's more. We also have a bunch of other Iditarod content, and that's why I want to bring in Alaska Public Media Digital Managing Editor Tegan Hanlon to talk about that. Hello, Tegan.
Hey, Casey.
What can our race watchers expect to see at alaskapublic.org?
Lots of good content from Lex and Ben out on the trail. We'll have stories. We'll have all of their photos from the trail. We'll also have the latest Iditapod episode. And if you head to alaskapublic.org/Iditarod, you can also sign up for our daily newsletter. It's free. It'll be delivered to your inbox every day of the race. It'll include the latest stories, the latest photos, some race analysis, and a dog of the day profile, plus the Iditapod episode. I like to kind of explain it as like the one-stop shop for our Iditarod coverage.
That's right. It's like the home base for all things Iditarod coming from Alaska Public Media. As you mentioned, including lots of cool photos and dog profiles. You know, every day we'll have a different dog that we'll introduce you to, and you can see what they look like if you actually go to alaskapublic.org. Ben, you actually have a dog profile for us already. The race hasn't even started yet.
So one of the dogs that you will meet is Dusty. Dusty looks like a small, compact Alaska Husky, a mix of brown and gray fur. And Dusty is the smallest dog on Jennifer Labar's team, 35 pounds. But you'll see in one of the photos, Dusty is full of energy, the spiritual leader, absolutely jumping, airborne. So this dog is the sister of the leader, Mavis. There's always a full family story to tell with these dogs. But the smallest dog, Dusty, is the dog that helped lead Jennifer Labar's team over, you know, Rosebud and Eagle Summits during the Quest. And it's this dog that has a small physical size, but just a huge, powerful attitude and brings a lot spiritually to Jennifer Labar's team.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, to be a good leader, you don't have to be a big dog. You just need to keep the team moving forward and in the right direction, I guess. And maybe some folks will find that inspiring. It's like Rudy or Seabiscuit, you could say. Well, so those dog profiles are a recurring feature here on the Iditapod. We are also bringing back our listener questions. We are working on an answer to one that we got already from somebody that didn't even know whether we were doing the Iditapod this year. We are, in fact, but it's going to take a little bit more effort, I think, to answer that one. It's a good question, so we're working on it. For now, though, I'll just tell you, the way to submit those questions, the absolute best way to submit those questions is to send us a voice memo of yourself asking the question, and then you get to be on the Iditapod yourself. It's kind of a cool thing. And you want to send that to us at iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Again, send us a voice memo of your question. It could be about dog mushing, the Iditarod, dogs, life in general. I don't know. We'll listen to it. We'll decide if we want to answer it. But yeah, send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Ben's showing me a picture of Dusty jumping straight up in the air with cool leg sleeves on. Now I want to meet that dog for myself. Seems like a really spunky little dog. So, folks, since we don't have a listener question and answer ready for today, I thought we'll just ask each other some random questions. And, you know, I guess who wants to go first? Lex looks like he's ready.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Tegan, who wasn't here during our discussion of Lance Mackey, what her memories are of covering Lance Mackey.
Good question.
Yeah, I feel like one core memory I have is it was several years ago and I was up in Fairbanks covering the Quest, but we wanted to meet up with Lance Mackey. It was me and an Anchorage Daily News photographer because we wanted to talk to him about getting ready to come back to the Iditarod. And we met up with him in like the middle of a snowstorm at this gas station restaurant north of Fairbanks. And he was there with his partner and his two young kids. And when we came in, he sort of like immediately broke down in tears. He was really upset because his like Raynaud's had flared up. And I bring up that story because it's a little bit sad, right? But it sort of underscored this like passion and determination that Lance had for the race. He was like sort of emotional about how he couldn't quit the Iditarod, even though his body was sort of rebelling, but he had to go back to the race. He had to race one more time. Meanwhile, he was like feeding his two young kids and playing with them. And it was just this like scene of sort of, I guess, kind of passion on numerous levels, right? For family, for the race. And yeah, it was just kind of like a powerful scene that maybe underscored his dedication to the sport, despite the numerous obstacles in his way and sort of challenges.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one reason why people identify with him so much is the kind of the ups and downs, the persistence and the drive to just kind of keep moving forward. My Lance Mackey story also is not from the race itself, but when the Yukon Quest was finishing in Fairbanks 6 or 7 years ago, it was the year that Matt Hall won. But yeah, Matt Hall is coming in on the Chena River into Fairbanks and people are starting to gather. A lot of people had gathered already, but there are people just kind of arriving at the Cushman Street Bridge, which is a good place to kind of watch the teams come in. And there were tourists, you know, you could kind of tell because they were like wearing this like brand new, you know, Canada Goose gear. It all matched and all that stuff. And they're bundled up way more than the normal sort of Fairbanks folks. And then this guy comes like bouncing down the street and he's got like patched holes in all of his down gear. And he's kind of just like talking and like, you know, random people walking by. And he's like, oh, hey, I'm here to see little Matt Hall come in. And of course, this is Lance Mackey. And these tourists are looking at him like, who in the world is that guy? Like, what is he doing? Why is this like boisterous sort of charismatic guy just walking down the street talking to every single person? And he kind of kept on towards the finish line to go see Matt come in. And I could tell that they were confused. So I turned to them and I said, that's Lance Mackey. You know, like you should know who that is. If you know anything about dog mushing, like, you know, the Chuck Norris of dog mushing.
Yeah, I feel like that's such a good point. He was so sort of real and authentic, and we all maybe missed his heyday when he was sort of this spectacular musher breaking records that no one had ever done before at the time. And even, you know, along the bumps in the road, whether it was health issues or drug issues, you know, everyone's imperfect, but you saw him like posting on Facebook about it or entering rehab really publicly. Like he was such this sort of public figure through the ups and downs of his career.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, he did some funny things out on the trail too, like little tricky mind games and things that, you know, just through experience, I think he knew probably A, it was going to give him an advantage. Like if he was able to sneak out while Jeff King was taking a nap that one time because he left his boots outside and he knew that the door, you know, and him putting his boots and stuff would wake Jeff up. Things like he would turn his headlamp off so that the mushers behind him couldn't see how far ahead he was. Also B, because it was more fun, you know, like to just do these funny things and kind of lighten up about this like really hardcore race across Alaska. It definitely will be missed. And I think, you know, probably we will hear a lot more about Lance Mackey. Maybe the mushers out on the trail will be telling stories. So that's something to probably look forward to. How about you, Ben? Do you have any Lance Mackey memories?
In Unalakleet one year, it was a warm day. It was, you know, 25, 30 degrees. People don't have hats on, no gloves on. But Lance Mackey shows up, and, you know, he's got the problem with his hands, the Raynaud's disease. And so Lance Mackey is taking care of his team on a warm day, but he's got huge polar bear mitts on. So he had to do all this dog care with mittens on so he could keep his hands warm and keep his fingers functioning. And he was still, on the hottest day, he still needed to really take care of himself physically to take care of his dog team.
Yeah. Ben, are you excited to be back? Are you nervous? What are you expecting kind of coming back from, I wouldn't say a retirement, but a hiatus, short hiatus?
This is my first year back on the trail since 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic hit during the middle of the race. So that race was a very special race in its own way. But I've been off for 2 years, and I've missed it. I've absolutely missed it. So I'm back out of Iditarod retirement and am super excited, definitely nervous, because I'm trying to remember how all of these things work. But it gets more real every single day, and it feels better and better as we get closer to March 4th.
Yeah.
I feel like there are so many mushers who retire and then they get drawn right back into the race a few years later. Maybe that's our Ben. He's our reporter that retires and then he comes back a couple of years later. Yeah. Can't get enough.
Can't quit it.
I have a quick question for Ben and Lex. What stories are you most excited to cover out on the trail? What should we look forward to from you guys?
I don't know. You know, I think going on the southern route after 4 years, I think that's going to be really interesting and probably something that will come up at least once they get out to that region of the trail. Sounds like the trail conditions are a little bit rougher than they were last year in some parts. They're lacking some snow. So I think we will see some, you know, I don't want to say mishaps, but I think that will definitely affect some of the mushers out there. And I also think just there's a rather notable sort of divide between some longtime mushers and teams and a lot of the rookies, as Ben has mentioned. So I think that'll be interesting to see how that sort of plays out on the trail, you know, whether there's a big gap and whether that continues in the future.
Yeah, that's a good point that we are returning to the southern route after, because of COVID and different reasons, that it hasn't been on that in 4 years. And so that means it's going to be going through, you know, more of these like ghost town checkpoints rather than villages.
The last time that we were on this route, the full southern route, was 2019. And there's two past champions in this year's race. One is Brent Sasluk, like we talked about, but the other is Pete Kaiser, who won in 2019. So that section of the trail that Lex mentioned, it really is tough. There's a lot of hills around Iditarod. It's longer. There's a lot of time going on the Yukon River that can be really hard. It can be soft, it can be slow, it can be whiteouts, it can be low visibility, it can be disorienting. So we've got a really challenging trail. So knowing that Pete Kaiser is coming off yet another Kuskokwim 300 championship, we know he's got a really good dog team. We know that there are, I guess, some mushers who aren't doing this, and I'm really excited to see who emerges. Are there some kind of sleeper champions that we haven't even talked about?
Yeah, no doubt. So Tegan, what do you think? Any themes, future predicting?
That's a good question. You know, it seems it's hard to ignore the size of the field. It's the smallest ever since even the first race ran in the 1970s. You know, at a high, there was, what was it, almost 100 racers?
96, yeah.
Yeah, at one point, the average is around 60, so it's like half the average number. So that's interesting in itself. It begs a lot of questions about the future of the Iditarod. But also, I don't know if that'll impact how the race sort of plays out. Will it be less crowded along the trail, more spread out? Maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad for trail navigation. I don't really know. It'll be interesting to see how that impacts checkpoints and the trail along the way to Nome.
Yeah, Lex mentioned, you know, whether or not there might be a gap that develops. I feel like that, that seems likely to me. But then at the same time, with fewer mushers, you might have more support available for those folks that are in the back of the pack. Because like once this giant circus or whatever, this parade has like gone through, the food gets eaten up, the volunteers are like worn out having to help them. And yeah, I mean, you show up and you're in like the Red Lantern position and it's, there isn't like a full crock pot of chili anymore, you know, like not necessarily. So maybe this year, you know, with fewer people, it might be easier to be a rookie or easier to be a back of the pack musher.
Yeah, that's a good point. I also wonder about the camaraderie, too. There's so many pros, cons, you know, because there's also points where you go into a checkpoint and there's all these mushers like swapping information about the trail or, you know, sharing info. And so maybe we won't see that as much, too. More food, maybe less camaraderie.
I mean, one thing we've been talking about just as we're getting ready for the ceremonial start on Saturday here in Anchorage is just the like logistics of talking to as many mushers as possible. Seems like that'll be a little easier for our little team because there just aren't as many of them. And, you know, you'll maybe have more time to talk to them and get those dog profiles and talk to race fans and stuff like that.
I was thinking that it may be entirely possible that for Lex and I to talk to every single musher at some point throughout this weekend and some point throughout the race, which doesn't happen every year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I covered at least the ceremonial start that year that there were 96 mushers, and it would have seemed ridiculous to try to talk to all of them. It would have been impossible, even with three or four people, you know. So that ceremonial start here in Anchorage on Saturday, that's when we'll be back with another episode of the IDITAPod that will probably drop Saturday night, maybe early Sunday morning, depending on where you're at. Then we'll start up our daily episodes on Monday through the end of the race. So please stay tuned. If you're not already, please subscribe and consider giving us a rating on whatever podcast app you're listening on, maybe even post a comment. Until then, our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Thanks to Lex Trinan, Ben Matheson, and Tegan Hanlon for being here. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Tough trail, and you know, of course, the gorge. You know, but I've been on technical trails, and I, you know, deep. You know, I think outside. I think what's. I guess to answer your question, with the renting a little space is just outside of Roan. Good dogs. Easy.